Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. As you can see from this intro, if you're watching this on YouTube, The Realignment was flown out to the Reagan Defense Forum at the Reagan Presidential Library this past weekend, where I recorded a bunch of great conversations with folks about the past, present, and future of the defense and national security spaces. We're going to intersperse these episodes over the coming month. But my first episode is a great conversation with the CTO of Palantir, a major tech company founded in the 2000s. We're discussing one of my favorite themes that I want to develop out moving into the future, this idea that during the 1990s, at the supposed end of history after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the defeat of the Soviet Union, we really dropped the ball across so many different categories, everything from finance to politics itself to, in the case of today's conversation, defense. Basically, what you had happen is the industry, along with the Pentagon, decided to consolidate from upwards of 50 defense companies to just a smaller number of players that would consolidate in order to reduce the overall amount of money that was spent on the space and be more efficient. Because with the defense cuts that you saw during the end of the Cold War, there wouldn't be enough budget to go around and support as big of a sector as you saw. As you know, we discussed in this conversation, on the one hand, that's kind of a good thing. It's good to have a peace dividend. It's good to have an opportunity to invest resources into our broader society. However, as we can now see in the year 2023, there was a very direct cost to that. That cost was we have an incredibly inefficient system. We've had monopolization. Those remaining defense companies were increasingly financialized, so they were driven more by Wall Street than by what actually needed to be done. So sitting here today, one of our key tasks moving forward is to reimagine the industry and actually approach a new entrance and new players to jump in. So hope this is all incredibly interesting, and this is definitely fitting into the news you can use category as we face the coming crisis in the space. Hope you all enjoy the conversation. Sean Shankar, welcome to The Realignment.
It's great to be here.
Great to chat with you. This is going to be a very history and present moment centric episode. Like I will link to a piece you wrote on Palantir's blog, and then of course we'll link to a speech you gave, which fits into themes we've been really interested in here. So let's kind of start here in the early 90s. Last Supper, what is it? What happens?
Yeah, so in 1993, we had defeated the Soviet Union, or it had defeated itself, however you want to think about it. Then Deputy Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, who was a Silicon Valley entrepreneur in a prior life, convened a group of the 50 largest, if you can imagine, we had 50 then, but the 50 largest defense primes in America for a dinner that was called the Last Supper. And the message at this dinner was, we need a peace dividend. The budget is going to get cut by 67%. So where you got $3 before, there's only going to be $1 to go around. Not all of you are going to survive. And we as the department are asking you to consolidate and merge, get smaller and leaner as a consequence. In other words, we as policy, we traded a monopoly in order to protect part of the industrial base under a new fiscal regime.
You know, it's so interesting because a key takeaway from your piece and just frankly a reading of the actual history and your speech is just that we can overuse the term military-industrial complex, because obviously it's an accurate term, like Eisenhower's speech is real, but there are different types of military-industrial complexes. And that basically gets into what we're discussing today, because you see an environment where the U.S. cut defense, cut bases, there was not going to be enough money to go around to support all these companies. So we see something that I think ostensibly we should really welcome. They're cutting budgets. They're reorienting the mission. There's also an alternate universe where instantly the military-industrial complex came together and said, okay, we're going to pivot to China. We need to keep up the threat so that we have to keep the budget. That isn't what happens. So how could this story have possibly gone wrong?
Yeah. Well, and I kind of don't blame, like when I think about the counterfactual, it's like, I think a peace dividend is reasonable. Like, you know, this is right. But some of the unintended consequences that accumulated over 30 years are kind of what we're living with and paying for now. And I think actually the first and most important of those that's not often talked about is, I think this was the beginning of the true financialization of defense. You know, these companies went from being about new venture formation, innovation and risk, high value R&D against mission needs, because you had this exigent threat, to there was no exigent threat. So what does the business become? The business becomes mergers and acquisitions. It's literally what they're asking you to do. It becomes about leverage ratios. It creates an opening for private equity to get involved. New venture formation becomes about consolidation. And when you have consolidation, it breeds conformity. And so the whole business side of defense, I think, really came out of this.
And quick thing, what's so interesting there is, in many ways, so many of the things we would criticize as military-industrial complex excess, that's actually basically what you're describing there under the process of financialization. That's why the key point I really kind of want to make here is that we can't just use this umbrella term. We have to actually look at how different iterations, structures, and key incentives are going to lead to different outcomes. Okay, so the financialization is the first consequence. What are some of the other ones?
The second one that I think is quite profound is conformity. Really bred a lack of founders. It's been 30 years since the department has really had to deal with the difficult personalities that kind of typify founders or creatives and the consequences of that. So, you think about someone like Kelly Johnson, maybe not a founder in the literal sense, but I would say he's the founder of Skunk Works at Lockheed Martin.
He's an inventor.
Yeah, he's an inventor, exactly. And, he was famously, as a 23-year-old, total amateur, looked at a 2D drawing and critiqued a senior engineer of like why this plane is screwed up. And the senior engineer wanted to get rid of him and said, okay, well, if you're so good, why don't you fix it? And he did, and this guy built like 26 airframes in his lifetime. He built the U-2 in 9 months. So like these people are special and you need them and they're difficult and they're complicated. Maybe another internal example would be like John Boyd, famous for coming up with the OODA loop, changing how we do fighting in the Air Force. I mean, people couldn't stand him. He was, thank goodness there was a 3-star general always kind of protecting him until the last moment. But this is a seminal figure who couldn't make general. And so that space, that need for the creatives, I think we lost it. We lost the ability to tolerate it is probably the right way of saying it.
And kind of the question here that I kind of wonder, and a couple in your actual speech, there's a presentation slide, and there's some examples of other types. So Henry Kaiser, famous shipbuilder during World War II. Bill Knudsen, taking his innovations from the auto industry and bringing them to the actual arsenal of democracy itself. It seems as if the defense industry you're describing in the 1990s, it's not just that, let's say, when that arrogant lieutenant colonel like Jerome Boyd is throwing his weight around too much and then is slapped down, but is now okay because it's the Cold War and the stakes are high. It's also that those people wouldn't be attracted to that defense industry in of itself. So there's not even an opportunity
Absolutely.
For John Boyd to get slapped down because a financialized, like, private equity, Wall Street-centric defense industry is not the type of place where you'd want where those rubber personalities would even be attracted to.
And I think that's what we kind of empirically saw, right? They migrated towards different types of tech companies in the Valley. And we're seeing the opportunity with the amount of capital that's being deployed in defense tech today. We're seeing the return of these sorts of folks. And that's a big, big part of what I've been spending time on is how do we help them succeed? How do we repave the way of what we had before? Recognizing how important that role was in the lead up to and through World War II. So like, forget about the Cold War for a second. The role, we talk about the arsenal of democracy, but it was, Henry Kaiser, not the Kaiser company at the time. It was John Northrop. Not Northrop Grumman, it was Glenn Martin, not Lockheed Martin. And so we kind of think of these as almost like big faceless institutions at this point, but they were all really founder-driven, highly creative, highly innovative enterprises driven by personalities.
I just did a conversation with Joe Lonsdale. I'm not sure which is going to air first, so apologies to the listeners. But basically, he makes this point that we are kind of at a decentralizing moment in our society. So it's not the 50s, it's not the big institutions. But given everything you just said, at the same time, the 30s and the 40s and the New Deal era are so big, they're so government-centric, you still have the individual really mattering. So it's just so interesting that a moment of almost peak decentralization, the rise of the individual in American society, we still don't have that instinct as much. So it really just does show that even within the broader societal trend, you have this real insulation from that broader way we're seeing our society evolve.
Absolutely.
So I guess the real thing, too, is before we get to the first breakfast, we get to 03, when Palantir, your company, comes about. So if the 1990s are about the end of history and our task isn't necessarily defeating adversaries, it's about dialing down what we have. 03 is obviously the post-9/11 world. Talk about how you all approach the space then.
Yeah, well, Palantir has really started because terrorism is awful. We want to prevent terrorism, But we also want to prevent the consequence of terrorism, which is the reaction that happens in society, the kind of knee-jerk desire to trade off privacy and civil liberties in order to get more security that may you may find yourself living in a world you didn't even want to be in anyways. And so there are lots of reasons in terms of how much it destroys the very underlying fabric of society to work on these problems. And so we started a company that set off with that mission to go do that. And I think this is the beginning of history in some sense. Like we realized, like, yes, history will keep going, the continuation of history. That was really hard because at that period of time, like, how do you start a company working with the government? When we started going around the valley, and you know, we had a pedigree, like the founders of Palantir also started PayPal and had been successful. All of the venture capitalists were like, "You guys seem like really smart people. It would be a shame to waste your life trying to build something for government. It's never going to work. Can't you build a trinket you'll sell to a bank instead? We'd love to give you a check for that." So structurally, there was really no support in the Valley for these sorts of things. Principally, I'd say even at that time for financial reasons. Over time, it also became for political reasons. And then when you go to D.C., they couldn't understand, why aren't you just selling me labor? Like, why are you trying to build software? What's this sort of investment? Why do I need outsiders involved? You know, we do software, too. What's this Valley thing? So, like, there was a huge rift between these two worlds. And so there was a lot of kind of wandering, you know, feeling like you have no home in either place, wandering through the desert, trying to get these things to work. I always point out that I think it's pretty ironic that at that point in time, the Intel community is more open and accessible than the Defense Department, and largely to the great credit of InQtel, which was started in 1999.
Gilman was on the podcast a few weeks ago, so
great.
Good lead in.
We were so naive when we got started. We didn't even know InQtel. We actually went to a VC who was trying to find a polite way to let us down, and they said, "You know, if InQtel invests in you, we might consider it." And we played it off like, "Yeah, of course, we'll go talk to them." And so InQtel was interested in what we're doing. The other firm never did invest, as I kind of foreshadowed here. But that ended up being massively valuable. And I think it really gets to another point, which is the capital markets in the U.S. are the best in the world. The issue for us was not capital. It was really validation from a credible party and access to that world. That you need a wormhole to kind of transport you from modern Silicon Valley to that defense or intelligence world. And InQtel provided that. They provided access to the customers, funding for the pilots, clearances to get going, all these kind of like non-market barriers that prevent innovators from going and solving these problems.
You know, I want you to do something that's very not DC, but a little more Silicon Valley. Just kind of think of an ideal world, because you're telling a really long historical story in both the speech and the essay. You're comparing the like 30s and like the Lend-Lease and like, you know, ramp up, we need demobilization. That wasn't a venture capital fueled enterprise. Modern venture capital didn't even exist. That's a, you know, mid stage like Cold War innovation, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, obviously, long standing history of venture capital, whaling, et cetera, et cetera. But venture capital as we know it today did not exist then. That was literally the government saying, "Hey, our political leaders have become convinced that there's this threat. We are going to ramp up defense spending, and here's this big pot of money." Which do you see, purely from a like thought exercise perspective, which would be better, a situation where the government did just pour vast amounts of money into companies, which was, again, which is what we did during World War II, they were government owned, versus we're going to bring in 100 more LPs, 100 more venture firms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because this kind of gets to how the American system is organizing itself for defense needs in the 21st century.
Yeah. I think there's a role for both, and I don't mean that to be kind of a non-answer to the question.
They do different things. Yeah, it's a real answer.
Exactly. So if you think about the scale up during like Lend-Lease, there wasn't a commercial market for these things. You know, you needed to build new factories, you needed to retool factories. That took about 18 months, which is kind of a point we could get to later about what is the sort of lead time for mobilization we should be thinking about. But and the government was going to be the buyer in the context of this monopsony. And so I think there was a great role for the government to create that market, and it did so across a distributed base of suppliers. No one company was really the company. There was many people competing for and delivering against even common platforms. I think what's unique about the moment that is, in some senses has been driven since World War II is the prosperity of America and the ability for dual-use things to drive our economic power and growth, which is another aspect of the same coin of national security. National security and American prosperity, or economic prosperity generally, are deeply bound together. It's hard to separate those concepts. And so if you think about a company like Intel, so when Bob Noyce, who was one of the co-founders of Intel and the CEO in the early days, he would never let go. You know, in the 60s, the government bought 96% of all integrated circuits. So it was the market for all intents and purposes. And presumably you could have just said, I'm just going to be a government contractor. But that was not what Bob Noyce wanted to do. Bob Noyce thought this integrated circuit thing, this microprocessor is going to change the world. It's going to be in everything. And I cannot let the government PM own my R&D roadmap. It's going to be too constrained. I'm going to miss that future. So he wouldn't let more than 4% of his R&D budget come from government funding. So this is where you need venture capital, right? He needed to finance an R&D roadmap that he believed in, that he was going to take risk on, that he thought was going to define the future of microprocessors. But and great, he succeeded massively, but so did America. The amount of prosperity as a consequence of that, both directly and indirectly from owning that technology, we take it for granted today. And there's so many examples where that's true. And I think there are also really painful examples where we miss that. The drone was our birthright. General Atomics made the drone. The Predator was the first drone. DJI as a company should not exist. The consumer market, there's a counterfactual world where instead of a General Atomics thinking, look, I'm a government contractor, I'm just providing this to the government, they really thought, look, I've perfected this thing here and the government is my first kind of, they're subsidizing the R&D, they have the highest need, I can industrialize this and consumer drones are going to change how we do agriculture, it's going to change how we do plant maintenance can change. I'm going to own this market from consumer to enterprise. We didn't get that world. We seeded that world. And I think there's something quite important there. Even if we think about the Cold War period, I think General Mills actually made the cereal company.
I was like, you mean, that wasn't a correction. General Mills, okay.
Yeah, they made inertial guidance systems for ICBMs. You know, we've kind of lost the thread of how much actually of the American economy was in some sense dual use and involved with things that really mattered for national security and other assets. They had other diversified interests that were providing for the economy.
I think what's interesting too is, and this is where we could be limited by metaphors and have to think in new ways. When you're doing that Last Supper, you're dividing up, like let's say, fighter jets. Which isn't exactly no one in the defense tech space is like, we're going to build the successor platform to the F-35. That very much is something that makes sense in the prime category. It's kind of funny. If you're into like fighter planes, you notice like, hey, it used to be just Grumman. It used to be just like McDonnell. Wait, now it's McDonnell Douglas. Now it's, you know, Lockheed Martin to your point. So here's the way to understand this then. What are the categories of our defense needs that you think fit into this defense tech centric area versus what are areas where there's plenty to critique about the F-35 process, but that's still largely going to be subject to the primes and reform there. Then you thinking, okay, it's time to seed all these new companies or support these new efforts.
Yeah. Well, I think Chris Broz wrote a really insightful piece that I think was entitled Moneyball Military.
Yeah.
And it's really this idea that, okay, for these big exquisite systems, maybe the process we have isn't so bad, but maybe we should have more than one approach to solving problems, which is like, okay, there are exquisite systems and there's this other thing. They're going to be attritable. They're going to be expendable. We're not buying it to manage it for 30 or 50 years. We're buying it because we might use it for between 1 and 5 years. And that then changes the entire potential business model space, right? If there's only going to be one fighter for the next 30 years, you better win. And winning it basically means everyone else is going to find some way of exiting the business. The government's going to try to manage this by saying, like, can't you make some of these guys suppliers to your program so that there's some hope of future competition? But in that way, everyone has become an extension of the government. It's not truly a competitive ecosystem. It can't be. It's not the fault of the companies. It's actually a fault of the market, which is driven by the monopsony. In the Moneyball military, you have a true competitive market. Multiple players can be there. You're going to be making buying decisions potentially every year, maybe even more than every year. New innovations can come to bear. You can change what you're buying from whom. And now you get more of that kind of American dynamism, like what we know how to do really well and how we innovate. And so I think there's a whole suite of problems that are going to, I don't think it's going to fit the aircraft carrier. But everything from software to these attritable systems, I think are really important. And by expanding the space, we're like, okay, we have an F-35. You see this with the Loyal Wingman or the CCA project, where it's like, yeah, we'll have an F-35, but we're also going to have cheap attritable systems around them that provide even more power and mass. And so it gives us new ways of fighting and new ways of thinking about this.
I'm curious, how competitive do you think the defense market should be? Because once again, competition and market-oriented principles are not quite the same, but they are related to financialization to a certain degree.
Absolutely. So I have two kind of contrarian thoughts around this.
And I just love asking this question to you because, like, this is the weird intersection of your Silicon Valley background and just, like, non-market-oriented DC reality.
Yeah. So the first is, I think one of the great problems with defense, but, you know, the critique of the defense industrial base is something like, it's kind of evil because people make too much money. And I think it's actually more like it lacks innovation, is inefficient because primes don't make enough money. You know, if you look at the revenue of Lockheed compared to its market cap, and you compare that to the revenue of Microsoft compared to its market cap, Microsoft is worth, every dollar of revenue is worth six times more, at least, to Microsoft than it is to Lockheed. And a lot of this is a consequence of the buyer, the government, basically trying to cap profits, saying, like, look, 10% or some percentage is a reasonable profit. Well, if that's the case, you, of course, have this structural march towards, in a cost-plus world, towards, hey, my costs need to grow, otherwise my profit can't grow. And that is the exact opposite incentive of the commercial world, where you're thinking, man, how do I innovate on my cost structure, share some of that benefit with the customer, but I want my margins to continue to expand. And so I've often said, actually, for defense tech and actually for the national interest, we want companies like Lockheed, or not to pick on them, but any of the primes, to be more valuable. We want to see their market cap going up. And I think the department should actually think about that as a KPI, not only for the primes, but for all of defense tech. If we aggregate the market cap of these companies, does the market say that we are helping make these companies more valuable? And that gives them more leverage, more talent, more power in the talent marketplace, more capital to reinvest in innovation for us and efficiency for us.
And sorry, to understand, how do we make them more valuable under this framework?
We improve the business model. So, okay. Right, so how do we get away from cost plus, where structurally the incentives are bad? It's just, the only way I can grow is by lobbying for the defense budget to get bigger. And for me to have more profit as a consequence of that. And we want something like, actually, as Palmer Luckey has said, I want to make $10 billion by saving the government $100 billion. That incentive does not exist today in the structure of defense, and we want that to exist. As taxpayers, we want that to exist, but I also think for innovation. And technology is supposed to make things better, cheaper, faster. And if you only have a push towards exquisite systems, they can be better, but they're not going to be cheaper or faster.
Yeah, that's helpful. So this is all leading up to then the first breakfast idea, which we referenced at the start of the conversation. Like, what is the first breakfast? Obviously, it's building off of the Last Supper.
Yeah, so I hope the first breakfast is kind of the antidote to the Last Supper. How do we get back to that world? And I think really just as a consequence of geopolitics, maybe a number of things, I think that moment is here. So there's roughly $100 billion of capital that's being invested in defense tech. We're both familiar with Mike Slaw and his work with the Venture Summit. There were 100 or more VCs there who are explicitly interested in deploying capital into defense. We have, as a consequence, we have plenty of founders and really creative, inventive personalities who want to go after these hard problems with risk capital. You know, they're not trying to have mediocre outcomes. Actually, we're set up in a world where we can have a few extraordinarily big winners that deliver true transformation. And sure, just like all of venture, 90% of these things may not work out. But that's going to deliver net innovation to the government if we get the winners to be truly big and transformative. And so that moment didn't exist 20 years ago. When we started doing this, really, we felt quite alone at Palantir trying to bring this innovation. Now, the amount of scale that's here and the amount of people who are trying to solve different hard problems, not just bits, but also atoms, people who are bending metal, it gives me a lot of hope. And so when I look at that, I think, great. But the one thing I have learned over the last 20 years at Palantir is essentially all of these barriers that exist, not for you to be successful, simply for you to get to the starting line to try to compete. And many of that we had to build as technology. You can kind of think of what we've had to do is we have our software, the product that we sell to the customer. We have all this software infrastructure that we had to build simply so that we could deliver our software to that customer. That's all beta in the kind of alpha beta dichotomy. I want to take that, and we've built it over 20 years. It's a significant amount of capability. I want to take that and bring it to all of these new entrants so that we can deliver this capability much faster to the end customer. And that's really born out of a belief that, as I like to say, M-Day was yesterday. You know, in the lead up, M-Day is mobilization day. In the lead up to World War II, there was this kind of naive assumption that magically at M-Day, when we decide we might need to fight, we'll just flip a switch, we'll turn on industrial production, things will kind of work. And how lucky were we? That was never going to work. How lucky were we, lucky in air quotes, that we had Lend-Lease? You know, we had this period of time when we were at peace, but we could fully mobilize our economy to a wartime economy. It took 18 months, 12 months to build a factory, 6 months to retool it. Then you had to ramp up production. And because we were supplying this to our allies, we got to build a lot of this infrastructure. That meant when we needed to meet our moment, we were already mobilized. Now, if we think about the present moment, we're not going to have the luxury of Lend-Lease. And if we think about America's greatest strength at the precipice of World War II, we had just figured out mass production. We were the world's best at mass production.
That's the KPI during that period. How many medium-range bombers can you churn out in X days? That's the metric which we're going to inevitably, almost certainly, win the war by.
Absolutely. I think on one of the production lines, the most famous one was turning out a bomber every 53 minutes. Yep. It's just cranking. Well, we're not the best at mass production anymore. And you're going to have to bend metal to win here, for sure. But we are the best at software, America. Collectively, people don't even say American tech. They just say tech because it would be like redundant. And the gap between us and number two is yawning. You kind of strain yourself to think about it. But for all sorts of structural reasons, we've prevented the most innovative, creative aspects of American tech from really deeply penetrating the department. This we have an opportunity to solve. And I think the sort of work that I'm focused on with First Breakfast can provide this wormhole to bring all of these companies straight to the starting line to really succeed. And I think this has really, besides the obvious mission capability benefits for the customer, I think it helps the government customer with one of their most vexing problems, which, in their world, they want a big tent ecosystem of vendors where they own and control the interfaces. And they have the ability to bring in and swap out the latest and greatest capabilities. I actually think the companies want that world too, because it means that you can compete on quality, not any of this non-market force stuff. You can win, you can iterate with users, deliver new capability, and grow your business. And that very much resembles the commercial world. It very much resembles something that more capital, more VC money can flow into, which feeds this virtuous cycle.
I think before we get into the specifics of the First Breakfast, I actually just love this idea, unironically. It's why I was so excited to speak with you. If the precipitating event for the Last Supper was just an Undersecretary of Defense just laying down the law, this is the deal. I like in the speech, you didn't say it here, but you said basically declared a Hunger Games, last five win. And that's quite a good way of understanding it, at a literal level. That's a culling if there ever was one. What is kind of the precipice for, given the stakes, given the timeline on Taiwan questions with China, is this as simple as an administration saying, no, guys, this is the deal? Is this as simple of a council of VCs, LPs, companies? How would an organizing event like that actually work? Because if we're just studying this history, which you've obviously done here, this is what I do with the podcast, I just lack the sort of vision of how any of the coalescing events that need to be happening are happening. So I'm kind of wondering, how do you actually just think this would happen?
Yeah. I don't know if I can answer it crisply in a single event, but I think there are a couple conversations that need to be had at this event.
Yeah.
One conversation is the VCs need to communicate to the department something that I think the department doesn't believe. There's a communication gap. So, in venture capital, it's a power law business. Your return is going to be dominated by really the most successful company in your portfolio, and you expect everything else to essentially go to zero or be break even. But you don't really care or spend time on it. As a consequence of this, you really just care about your winners. And more generally, as a VC ecosystem, you care that there are winners. You care that someone is winning big. Of course, you
prefer it to be you. That's what draws more LPs into the...
Yes.
You need the LPs to be excited in the first place.
It's the whole category dies.
Yeah.
It's
risky, right? That's the whole thing.
Now, the department, kind of in their DNA, I think it's a subconscious thing. I would say even more generally government, they don't like this. The idea that most people are going to lose and a few of these people are going to get big, that seems really unfair. It seems like that's not what we do for a living. Something about this is difficult for them. Mm-hmm. So the natural inclination is to kind of peanut butter spread a small amount of money across a large number of folks. This is going to lead to a complete collapse of the VC ecosystem that's interested in defense tech. So this conversation between the capital class and the department needs to happen, where they understand, oh, We do need to pick a few really big winners. You know, it's important that we're more right than we're wrong, but no one's 100% right. Let's not pretend that's even possible. Even the commercial markets don't work that way, right? We need to make decisions. Now, the second conversation that needs to happen is really around timelines and reality on fielding software. You know, if we have to fight between now and, let's say, 2025, you're not fielding any new exquisite capability. Mm-hmm. The only thing that can be fielded between now and then is software. And we need to start thinking about software as a weapon system. We need to start thinking about the ideal commanders are going to be commanders who are, in some sense, product managers. They understand that software is malleable, and I, as the commander, can say, change these things, make it work this way. My software engineers are part of my fighting force. This is a whole new concept of fighting, and I see this play out in the field, where there are some commanders who get this deeply and they have profoundly different effects than other commanders who view this sort of technical thing as someone else's job. Mm-hmm. I just use the capability that's given to me. And I think a lot of this comes down to the deep desire to drive outcomes through process. Look, if we have process, we're going to institutionalize these outcomes. Mm-hmm. We're going to be able to figure it out, instead of just a fundamental acceptance and recognition that there's only content. Yeah. That, process is going to drive us all towards mediocrity. Yeah, you're right. You may not have this thing blow up on you the way that you would if you didn't have process, but you're not going to have the exceptional outcome either. And there's a great Lost interview with Steve Jobs where he talks about this, where, you know, he's like, companies get confused. They're trying to replicate their first success. And they say, well, what was the process we used to drive that first success? And they screw it up. And part of this, it comes back to this, the founders and the difficult person. He's like, look, content, there's just content, and content people are a pain in the butt, I think is his quote. They're a pain in the butt to manage. Yeah. And I think my boss would say that's true of me, and I certainly feel like the content people under me are, you know, they're charming.
I think the last question, I like this idea you have, but it's kind of missing something. The description of the founder persona in this space. It captures something because you're describing a type of personality. But critically, you know, Bill Knudsen is not a founder. He's an innovator, but he's like very much working within a structure. And as you're talking about, like, critically, we got those 18 months right during Lend-Lease. Those are political leaders, military leaders. Those are not certainly people who you would probably hire onto your tech company or to the auto industry in the day. And then you do have people up and coming like John Boyd, who's like a second lieutenant, first lieutenant, major, stops at colonel to his disagreeability. There's this broad category in the ecosystem that includes these founders, but more than just that. Where do we find these people? The real question is, and this, I think, gets to the process difficulty. How do you create a process by which you could identify these people in a proactive manner? Because I've just not witnessed in my surveys of this space efforts to kind of identify and unify these things. Because here's what, let me just give you the thing I worry about. There's this kind of short, I've talked about this most of my guests today, there's this kind of shorthand of like, oh, well, you know, the auto industry was the center of America before World War II. So during World War II, you then took Bill Knudsen from the auto industry, got him on the assembly line, and he develops the process. You literally commission him as the highest ever direct commissioned general in American history. He goes from civilian to 3-star, and that's the whole thing. Well, today, and you know this more than I do, but having interviewed a lot of founders, there are plenty of brilliant SaaS founders. There's plenty of brilliant PMs who I would not just take and input into a military system or into the defense industrial base. So I worry about kind of the limits here. So this is just kind of like my big ramp. No, I'd love to hear what you think about this.
I really mean almost like a difference. When I mean founder, maybe a better word is something like an owner.
I love more that. Well, keep the founder part because you're speaking to a tech audience. But I think for RNDF purposes, your owner is great because people can be owners. You could be a second lieutenant owner, and that's a skill set. I love that. Yeah, so keep going.
Yeah, I think so. There's a mindset around this stuff. And I think one of the things I often say is that, you know, I think there's a quote from Airbnb that culture eats strategy for breakfast. And I think maybe even before culture, talent spotting it eats everything for breakfast. You know, you mentioned Joe earlier. Right? Yeah. Like the first 50 employees at Palantir were completely talent spotted by him. And some people are good. I don't know how to describe why someone might be good at this, how this. But what you can tell is someone is extraordinarily talented, and we need to reorganize our efforts around this person in these areas. And so how do we kind of aspire to create institutions that are artist colonies, not factories?
Yeah.
The kind of default mode is, hey, we're going to industrialize. Hey, I'm going to give you a career ladder, which is highly inauthentic.
Anti-ownership, once again, your framework.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's celebrate the artist. Like, you don't get Dali to paint better by telling him he should paint more like Monet. Mm-hmm. And individual craft and pride in that and a cultivation of ownership. I think one of the things about, you know, very smart people is they can be taught almost nothing, but they can learn. Mm-hmm. And so how do we reimagine our institutions as places that they're continuously learning? And for that to really happen, you have to give them ownership.
I really love that. That's an excellent place to close this conversation. And you should write a follow-up essay on ownership. I really mean it, because I think I actually love the ownership metric, because I think it's one which actually bunches of people in different. So let me give you an example. So my sister-in-law, she was just promoted to captain in the Marine Corps. She's in the artillery arm. You could tell her the word ownership and she will understand what that means. And you could have her orient her institution, her instruction around promoting that within herself. So I think that I'm just jazzed. I think you should spend more time thinking about that, because that's a great metric and way to think about it.
That's awesome.
Thanks for joining me on the show.
Yeah.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.